Any time after that, right? He asked. Right, Cloudy said. It only marks when it was made, not when it was used in a camera. Something didn't add up about that. The film was manufactured as early as April of 1970, and the photographer Dominic Santinello was killed in December 1970. He could have easily bought and used the film sometime in the 8 intervening months, then sent it home with his belongings. You know where that is, right? Cloudy asked. Yeah, the Del Coronado, Bosch said. Sure hasn't changed much. Yeah. Bosch stared at the photo of mother and child again, and then he got it. He understood. Dominic Santinello trained down in the San Diego area in 1969, but he would have been shipped overseas before the end of the year. Bosch was looking at photos taken in San Diego in April 1970, at the very earliest, and that was well after Santinello was in Vietnam. He came back, Bosch said. What? Cloudy asked. Bosch didn't answer. He was riding the wave. Things were cascading, coming together. The civvies in the box, the long hair and the bristles of the brush, the photos removed from inside of the footlocker, and the hidden photos of the baby on the beach. Santinello had made an unauthorized trip back to the States. He hid the photo negatives because they were proof of his crime. He had risked court-martial and the stockade to see his girlfriend and his newborn daughter. Bosch now knew there was an heir somewhere out there, born in 1970. Whitney Vance had a granddaughter. Bosch was sure of it. Chapter 17. Cloudy put all of the photos into a stiff cardboard folder to keep them from getting bent or damaged. In the car, Bosch opened the folder and looked at the photo of the woman and the baby one more time. He knew there were a lot of aspects of his theory to confirm, and some that could never be confirmed. The film negatives that produced the photos in the folder were found secreted in Nick Santinella's camera, but that did not necessarily mean he had taken the photos himself. The photos could have been taken for him, and then the negatives mailed to him in Vietnam. Harry knew it was a possibility that could not be completely dismissed, but his gut told him that it was an unlikely scenario. The negatives had been found with his camera and other negatives of photos taken by him. It was clear to him Santinello had taken the shot of the woman and the baby. The other question that hung over the theory was why Santinello would keep his relationship and fatherhood secret from his family, most notably his sister, back in Oxnard. Bosch knew that family dynamics were almost as unique as fingerprints, and it might take several more visits with Olivia to get to the truth of the relationships within the Santinello family. He decided that the best use of his time would be to prove or disprove that Santinello was Whitney Vance's son, and that he may have produced an heir, the baby in the Hotel Del Coronado photos. The other explanations could come later, if they still mattered at that point. He closed the folder and snapped the attached elastic band back around it. Before starting the car, Bosch pulled out his phone and called Gary McIntyre, the investigator at the National Personnel Records Center. The day before, Olivia McDonald had written an email to McIntyre granting Bosch permission to receive and review records of her brother's military service. He now checked with McIntyre on the status of his search.
Just finished pulling everything together, McIntyre said. It's too big to email. I'll drop it in our download site and email you the password.
Bosch wasn't sure when he would get to a computer terminal to download a dense digital file, or if he could even figure out how to do it.
That's fine, he said, but I'm on the road today heading to San Diego and I'm not sure I can access it. I'd love knowing what you came up with during his training, since I'll be down there.
Bosch let that hang in the air. He knew a guy like McIntyre would be slammed with records requests from all over the country and needed to move on to the next case. But Harry hoped that the intrigue involved in the Santinello file, a soldier killed 46 years earlier, would win the day and push McIntyre toward answering at least a few questions on the phone. The NCIS investigator probably spent most of his days pulling files on Gulf War vets accused of drug and alcohol-infused crimes
or locked up in Baker Act wards. Finally, McIntyre responded. If you don't mind hearing me eat the meatball sub that was just delivered to my desk, I can go through the stuff and answer a few questions. Bosch pulled out his notebook. Perfect, he said. What are you looking for? McIntyre asked. Just so I have it right, can we start with the short version of his postings? You know, where and when? Sure. Bosch took notes as McIntyre, between loud bites of his sandwich, read off the record of Santinello's military assignments. He had arrived at boot camp at the San Diego Naval Training Center in June 1969. Upon graduation, he received orders, moving him to the Hospital Corps School at Balboa Naval Hospital. His training was then continued at the Field Medical School at Camp Pendleton in Oceanside, and in December, he was ordered to Vietnam, where he was assigned to the hospital ship Sanctuary. After 4 months on the boat, he received a TAD, Temporary Additional Duty, to 1st Medical Battalion in Da Nang, at which point he started accompanying Marine recon units into the bush. He remained with 1st Med for 7 months, until he was killed in action. Bosch thought of the Zippo lighter with the Subic Bay chevron that he had found among Santinella's belongings in Olivia McDonald's attic. It was still in its box, and appeared to be a keepsake. "So he was never in Olongapo?" he asked. "No, not on here," McIntyre said. Bosch thought maybe Santinello had gotten the Zippo in a trade with a medic or soldier who had previously been assigned to the base in the Philippines, possibly someone he had served with or cared for on the Sanctuary. What else? McIntyre asked. Okay, I'm trying to find people I can talk to, Bosch said. People he was tight with? Do you have the orders for his TAD from basic to Balboa? He waited. He was about to ask McIntyre to go further than he probably anticipated, when he agreed to answer questions while eating. From his own experience, Bosch knew that because of the random nature of a soldier's training and assignments in the military, few relationships lasted. But because Santinello was on a trajectory of training as a combat medic, there might be one or two other corpsmen who made the same journey, and it was likely they would have bonded as the familiar faces in a sea of strangers. "Yeah, got it," McIntyre said. "Does it list all personnel transferred on the same orders?" Bosch asked. "Yes, 14 guys from his basic training class went to Balboa." "Okay, good. Now what about the orders from Balboa to Field Medical at Pendleton? Is there anybody on that list who he went through all three steps with?" "You mean basic to Balboa to Pendleton? Shit, that could take all day, Bosch." "I know it's a lot, but if you have the list there, is there anybody on that list of 14 that went with him to Pendleton?" Bosch thought the request was less involved than McIntyre was indicating, but he wasn't going to suggest that. "Hold on," McIntyre said gruffly. Bosch was silent. He didn't want to possibly say the wrong thing and halt the cooperation. 4 minutes went by before he heard any sounds, including eating, from McIntyre. "Three guys," he finally said. "So three guys were in all three training classes with him?" Bosch asked. "That's right. You ready to copy?" "Ready." McIntyre recited and spelled three names: Jorge Garcia Lavin, Donald C. Stanley, and Hallie B. Lewis. Bosch recalled the name Lewis being stenciled on the shirt that Santinello was wearing in the photo Olivia had shown him. He took it as a sign that the two were tight. He now had a direction. "By the way," McIntyre said, "two of these guys were KIA. The air went out of Bosch's hope of finding someone who could help him identify the woman and baby in the Del Coronado photograph. "Which ones?" he asked. "Garcia, Lavin, and Stanley," McIntyre said. "And I really need to get back to my work, Harry. All this is in the file you can download." "I'll grab it as soon as I can," Bosch said quickly. "One last quick question, then I'll let you go. Hallie B. Lewis, you have a hometown or DOB to go with that name?" "Says here, Tallahassee, Florida. That's all I've got." "Then that's what I'll take. I can't thank you enough, Gary. Have a great day." Bosch disconnected, started the car, and headed west toward the 170, which would take him up to San Fernando. His plan was to use the SFPD computer to track down Hallie B. Lewis and see what he could remember about his fellow corpsman Dominic Santinello. As he drove, he thought about the percentages. 4 men go through basic training, preliminary medical training, and then combat medical school together. Then they get shipped to Vietnam together, and only one out of four makes it back home alive. Bosch knew this from his own experience in Vietnam that corpsmen were high-value targets. They were number three on every VC sniper's list, after the lieutenant and radio man on a patrol. You take out the leader, then you take out communications. After that, take out triage, and you have an enemy unit in complete fear and disarray. Most of the corpsmen Bosch knew wore no markings indicating what their role was in a recon mission. Bosch wondered if Hallie B. Lewis knew how lucky he had been. Chapter 18. Bosch called Whitney Vance's private number on his way to San Fernando and got the straight-to-message beep again. He once again asked Vance to call him back. After disconnecting, he wondered what Vance's status was as a client. If he was no longer communicating with Bosch, was Bosch still working for him? Harry was well into the case, and his time was paid for. Either way, he wasn't stopping what he had started. He took a shot in the dark and called directory assistance for Tallahassee, Florida. He asked for a listing for Hallie B. Lewis, and was told there was only one listing under that name, and it was for a law office. Bosch asked to be connected, and soon the call was answered by a secretary, who put Bosch on hold when he identified himself and said he wanted to talk to Mr. Lewis about Dominic Santanello from the Field Medical School at Camp Pendleton. At least a minute went by, and Bosch used the time to formulate what he would say to the man, should he get on the line, without violating his confidential agreement with Vance. "This is Hallie Lewis," a voice finally said. "What is this about?" "Mr. Lewis, I'm an investigator out in Los Angeles," Bosch said. "Thank you for taking my call. I'm working on an investigation involving the late Dominic Santanello. I'll say he's late. Nick died almost 50 years ago." "Yes, sir, I know. What could you possibly be investigating about him?" Bosch dropped into his prepared response. "It is a confidential investigation, but I can tell you it involves trying to determine if Dominic left behind an heir." There was a moment of silence before Lewis responded. "An heir? He was about 19 when he got killed in Vietnam." "Correct, sir. He was a month short of his 20th birthday. It doesn't mean he couldn't have fathered a child." "And that's what you're trying to find out?" "Yes. I'm interested in the period he was in San Diego County for basic training through his training at Balboa and Pendleton. I'm working with NCIS on this, and their investigator told me that you were in the same units with Nick until he received orders to Vietnam."
"That's true.
Why is the NCIS involved in something like this?" "I made contact to get Nick's military records archive, and we were able to determine that you were one of three men who was in all three training stops with Nick. You're the only one still alive."
"I know. You don't have to tell me."
Bosch had taken Victory Boulevard into North Hollywood and now turned north on the 170. The fortress of the San Gabriel Mountains crossed his entire windshield.
"So why would you think I might know anything about whether Nick had a kid or not?" Lewis asked.
"Because you two were tight," Bosch said.
"How would you know that?
Just because we were in the same training units doesn't..."
"He took that swim test for you. He put on your shirt and got counted as you."
There was a long silence before Lewis asked Bosch how he knew that story.
"I saw the photo," Bosch said. "His sister told me the story."
"I haven't thought about that in a long time," Lewis said.
"But to answer your question, I don't know if Nick had an heir. If he fathered a child, he didn't tell me."
"If he fathered a child, she would have been born after you all received orders at the end of Field Medical School. Nick would have been in Vietnam."
"And I in Subic Bay."
"You said she?"
"I saw a photo he took. It showed a woman and a baby girl on the beach by the Del Coronado. The mother was Latina."
"Do you remember him with the woman back then?"
"I remember a woman. Yes, she was older, and she put the hex on him."
"The hex?"
"He fell under her spell. That was toward the end, when we were at Pendleton. He met her in a bar in Oceanside. They came up there looking for guys like him."
"What do you mean, like him?"
"Hispanic? Mexican? There was all this Chicano pride stuff going on down there at that time. It was like they recruited the Mexican guys off the base. Nick was brown, but his parents were white, and I knew that because I met them at the graduation. But he told me he was adopted, and he knew that his real mother was Mexican. These people tapped into that, I guess, his true identity, you know?"
"And this woman you mentioned was part of that?"
"Yes. I remember we tried to talk sense into him, me and Stanley, but he said he was in love. It wasn't the Mexican thing, it was her.
You remember her name?
No, not really, it was so long ago.
Bosch tried to keep his disappointment out of his voice.
What did she look like?
Dark hair, pretty. She was older, but not too old. 25, maybe 30. He said she was an artist.
Bosch knew that if he kept Lewis thinking back to that time, more details might come to him.
Where did they meet?
Must have been the Surf Rider. We hung out there a lot. Or one of those bars near the base.
And he'd go to see her on weekend leave?
Yeah. There was this place down in San Diego where he would go to see her when he got liberty. It was in the barrio, and under a freeway or a bridge, and they called it Chicano Way or something like that. It was so long ago, it's hard to remember. But he told me about it. They were trying to make it like a park, and they painted graffiti on the freeway. He started calling those people his new familia. He used the Spanish, and that was funny, because he didn't even speak Spanish. He had never learned.
It was all interesting information, and Bosch could see where it fit with other parts of the story he already had. He was thinking of what to ask next, when the true payoff to the shot in the dark call to Tallahassee came.
Gabriella, Lewis said. It just came to me.
That was her name? Bosch said. He had failed to keep the excitement out of his voice.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure now, Lewis said. Gabriella.
Remember a last name, Bosch tried?
Lewis laughed. Man, I can't believe I pulled her first name up out of the muck.
It's very helpful. Bosch started shutting the conversation down. He gave Lewis his phone number and asked him to call if he remembered anything else about Gabriella or Santanello's time in San Diego.
So you returned to Tallahassee after you served, Bosch said, just to move the conversation toward a close.
Yes, I came right back, Lewis said. Had enough of California, Vietnam, all of it. I've been here ever since.
What kind of law do you practice?
Oh, just about any kind of law you need. In a town like Tallahassee, it pays to diversify. I like to say the one thing I won't do is defend FSU football players. I'm a Gator, and can't cross that line.
Bosch guessed he was speaking to some sort of state rivalry, but it was beyond him. His knowledge of sports had only recently stretched past the Dodgers to a cursory interest in the return of the L.A. Rams.
Can I ask you something? Lewis said. Who wants to know if Nick left an heir?
You can ask, Mr. Lewis, but that's the one question I can't answer.
Nick had nothing, and his family didn't have much more. This has got to do with his adoption, right?
Bosch was silent. Lewis had nailed it.
I know you can't answer, Lewis said. I'm a lawyer. I guess I have to respect that.
Bosch decided to get off the line before Lewis put anything else together and asked another question.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis, and thank you for your help.
Bosch disconnected and decided to continue to San Fernando, even though he had already found Lewis. He would check in on matters relating to the screen cutter and do some internet work to confirm the information Lewis had provided, but he knew without a doubt that he would eventually be heading south to San Diego on the case. A few minutes later, he turned onto First Street in San Fernando and saw the three television trucks parked in front of the police station.
Chapter 19.
Bosch entered the police station through the side door and headed down the back hall to the detective bureau. At the crossroads with the main hallway, he looked right and saw a gathering of people outside the door to the roll call room. Among them was Bella Lourdes, who caught Bosch in her peripheral vision and signaled him over. She was wearing jeans and a black golf shirt with the SFPD badge and unit designation on the left breast. Her gun and real badge were on her belt.
What's going on? Bosch asked.
We got lucky, Lourdes said. The screen cutter made an attempt today, but the victim got away. The chief said that's enough. He's going public.
Bosch just nodded. He still thought it was the wrong move, but he understood the pressure on Valdez. Having sat on knowledge of the previous cases was going to look bad enough. Lourdes was right about that. They were lucky the chief wasn't in the roll call room telling the media about a fifth rape.
Where's the victim? Bosch asked.
In the war room, Lourdes said. She's still pretty shaky. I was giving her some time.
How come I wasn't called?
Lourdes looked surprised.
The captain said he couldn't reach you.
Bosch just shook his head and let it go. It was a petty move on Trevino's part, but there are more important things to worry about.
Bosch looked over the heads of Lourdes and the others in the hallway to try to get a glimpse of the press conference. He could see Valdez and Trevino at the front of the room. He could not tell how many members of the media had shown up, because the reporters would be sitting and the camera operators would be at the back. He knew it all depended on what else was going on in Los Angeles that day. A serial rapist on the loose in San Fernando, where the population largely ignored English-language media, was probably not a massive draw. He had seen that one of the media trucks outside was from Univision Noticias. That would get the word out locally.
"So did Trevino or Valdez talk about a control?" he asked.
"A control?" Lourdes asked.
"Holding something back that only we and the rapist would know? So we can kick out false confessions, confirm a true confession?"
No, that didn't come up.
"Maybe Trevino should have actually tried to call me instead of trying to run a play on me."
Bosch turned away from the group.
"You ready to go back and talk to her?" he asked. "How's her English?"
"She understands English," Lourdes said, "but likes to speak in Spanish."
Bosch nodded. They started down the hall toward the detective bureau. The war room was a large meeting room next to the bureau, with a long table and a white board wall where raids, cases, and deployments could be D&D'd, diagrammed and discussed. It was usually used for operations like DUI task force sweeps and parade coverage.
"So what do we know?" Bosch asked.
"You probably know or recognize her," Lourdes said. "She's a barista at the Starbucks. She works part-time on the morning shift, 6 to 11 every day."
"What's her name?"
"Beatriz, with a Z. Last name Sahagun."
Bosch couldn't connect the name with the face. There were three women who were usually working at Starbucks in the mornings when he came in. He assumed he would recognize her when he got to the war room.
"She went right home after work," Bosch said.
"Yes, and he's waiting for her," Lourdes said. "She lives on 7th, a block off of McClay. Fits the profile. Single-family house, residential abutting commercial. She comes in and immediately knows something's off."
"She saw the screen?"
"No, she didn't see anything. She smelled him."
"Smelled him?"
"She just said she came in and the house didn't smell right. And she remembered our fuck-up with the mailman. She was working there at the Starbucks that day we took Marin down. Then the next time he came in for his coffee and breakfast sandwich, he told the girls behind the counter that the police had mistaken him for a rapist that was hitting in the neighborhoods. So she was immediately alarmed. She comes home, something isn't right, and she grabs a broom in the kitchen."
"Holy shit, brave girl. She should have gotten out of there."
"Fucking A, I know. But she sneaks up on him. Comes into the bedroom and knows he's behind the curtain. She can tell, so she takes a swing with the broom like Adrian Gonzalez and clocks the guy right in the face. He falls out, brings the curtain down with him. He's dazed, doesn't know what the fuck happened, and then just jumps through the window and books it. We're talking right through the glass."
"Who's working that scene?"
"The A-team, and the captain put Sisto on it to babysit. But Harry, guess what? We got the knife."
"Wow."
"He dropped it when she hit him, and then it got tangled up in the curtain and he left it. Sisto just called me when they found it."
"Does the chief know about it?"
"No.
That's our control. We need to tell Sisto and the A-team to keep it on the down low."
"Got it.
What mask was he wearing?"
"Didn't get to that yet with her.
What about her menstrual cycle?"
"Didn't ask about that either."
They were now at the door to the war room.
"Okay," Bosch said. "You ready?
You take lead."
"Let's do it." Bosch opened the door and held it as Lourdes went in first. He immediately recognized the woman sitting at the big table as someone who made his iced lattes at the Starbucks around the corner. She was always smiling and friendly, and was usually making his drink before he had even ordered it. Beatriz Sahagun was texting someone on her phone as they entered. She looked up solemnly and recognized Bosch. A small smile played on her face.
"Iced latte," she said.
Bosch nodded and smiled back. He offered his hand and she shook it.
"Beatriz, I'm Harry Bosch. I'm glad you're okay."
Bosch and Lourdes took seats across the table from her and began asking her questions. With the general story already known, Lourdes was able to take a deeper dive, and new details emerged. On occasion, Bosch would ask a question, and Lourdes would repeat it in Spanish to make sure there was no misunderstanding. Beatrice answered the question slowly and thoughtfully, and that allowed Bosch to understand most of what was said without needing Lourdes to translate back to him. Beatrice was 24 years old and fit the physical profile of the screencutter's prior victims. She had long brown hair, dark eyes, and a slight build. She had worked at Starbucks for 2 years, and primarily as a barista, because her English language skills were not up to the level required for taking orders and payments. She reported to Bosch and Lourdes that she had had no troubling encounters with customers or fellow employees. She had no stalkers or issues with former boyfriends. She shared her house with another Starbucks barista, who usually worked the day shift and was gone at the time of the intrusion. In the course of the interview, Beatrice revealed that the intruder in her house was wearing a Lucha Libre wrestling mask, and she offered the same description of it as the previous screencutter victim: black, green, and red. She also revealed that she had tracked her menstrual cycle on a calendar she kept on her bedside table. She explained that she was raised as a strict Catholic and had practiced the rhythm method of birth control with her former boyfriend. The detectives paid particular attention to what had alerted Beatrice to the possibility that there was an intruder in her house: the smell. Under careful questioning, she revealed that she believed it was not the smell of cigarettes, but the smell exuded by someone who smokes. Bosch understood the distinction and thought it was a good get. The screencutter was a smoker. He didn't smoke while he was in her house, but he had a scent trail that she picked up on. Beatrice hugged her body during most of the interview. She had acted instinctively to find the intruder rather than to flee, and now in the aftermath was realizing how risky a decision it had been. When they were finished with the interview, the detective suggested that they take her out the side door to avoid any reporters still in the vicinity. They also offered to take her home to gather clothes and belongings she would need for at least the next few days. It was recommended that she and her roommate not stay in the home for a while, both because crime scene techs and investigators would want access and for security reasons. The detectives did not specifically suggest that the screencutter might come back, but it wasn't far from their minds. Lourdes called Sisto to give him the heads up that they were coming, and then they drove in Lourdes' city car over to the victim's house. Sisto was waiting in front of the house. He was born and raised local, and the SFPD was the only department he had ever worked for. Lourdes had outside experience with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department before coming over to San Fernando. Sisto was dressed similarly to Lourdes in jeans and black golf shirt. It seemed to be the casual detective uniform employed most often by the pair. Since coming to work at SFPD, Bosch had been impressed with Lourdes' skill and dedication, and less so with Sisto's. He appeared to Bosch to be marking time. He was always on his phone texting, and was more likely to discuss the morning surf report when making small talk than to bring up cases or police matters. Some detectives put photos and other reminders of cases on their desks and bulletin boards. Some put reminders of their interests outside the job. Sisto was one of the latter. His desk was festooned with surfing and Dodgers paraphernalia. Looking at it the first time, Bosch could not even tell it was a detective's desk. Lourdes stuck close to Beatrice as she went into the house and gathered clothes and toiletries into a suitcase and duffel bag. After she was packed, Lourdes asked if she could tell her story once more and walk the investigators through it. Beatrice obliged, and once again Bosch marveled at her choice to go through the house looking for the intruder rather than to run as fast as she could from the premises. Lourdes volunteered to drive Beatrice to her mother's home, also in San Fernando, and Bosch stayed behind with Sisto and the forensic team. He first inspected the rear window, where the screen had been cut out, and the initial entry made into the house. It was very similar to the other cases. Bosch next asked Sisto to show him the knife that was recovered from the tangle of the fallen curtain. Sisto pulled a plastic evidence bag from a brown paper bag holding several collected items. "Forensics already checked it," Sisto said. "It's clean. No prints. Guy wore gloves and a mask." Bosch nodded as he studied the knife through the plastic. It was a black folding knife, and the blade was open. He could see the manufacturer's logo stamped on the blade, along with some code numbers too small and difficult to read through the plastic. He would make sure he looked at it back in the controlled environment of the detective bureau. "Nice knife, though," Sisto added.
I looked it up on my phone. It's made by a company called Titanium Edge. It's called SOCOM Black. The powder black plate is so it doesn't reflect light. You know, when you're out at night and have to shank somebody. He said it with sarcasm that didn't amuse Bosch.
Yeah, I know, Bosch said.
I looked at a couple of knife blogs while I was waiting here. Yes, they have knife blogs. A lot of them say the SOCOM Black is one of the best out there.
Best for what? Bosch asked.
Scary shit, I guess. Wet work. SOCOM probably stands for some kind of Special Forces Black Ops stuff.
Special Operations Command. Delta Force.
Sisto looked surprised. Whoa, I guess you know your military shit.
I know a few things. Bosch carefully handed him back the knife. Bosch wasn't sure what Sisto thought of him. They had little interaction, even though their desks in the bureau were only a privacy wall apart. Sisto handled property crimes, and Bosch wasn't spending his time on unsolved property crimes, so there had been little reason for conversation beyond the routine salutations each day. Bosch assumed that Sisto, who was half Harry's age, viewed the older detective as some kind of relic from the past. The fact that Bosch most often wore a jacket and tie when he came in to work for free was probably confounding to him as well.
So the blade was not folded when you found it? Bosch asked. The guy was behind the curtain with the blade out?
Yes. Out and ready, Sisto said. Think we ought to fold it close so nobody gets cut?
No. Book it the way you found it, and just be careful with it. Warn people it's open. Maybe see about getting a box when you take it back to evidence control.
Sisto nodded as he carefully placed the knife back in the larger evidence bag. Bosch stepped over to the window and looked down at the broken glass in the backyard. The screen cutter had hurled himself into the window and broken through the framing as well as the glass. Bosch's first thought was that he had to have been hurt. The whack with a broomstick must have been so stunning that he chose to flee instead of fight, the opposite reaction of his intended victim. But going through the window and taking out the frame as well as the glass took a lot of force.
Any blood or anything in the glass? He asked.
Not that we found so far, Sisto said.
You got the word on the knife, right? We don't talk about it with anybody, especially the brand and model.
Roger that. You think people are really going to come in and confess to this?
I've seen stranger things. You never know.
Bosch pulled his phone and started moving away from Sisto so he could make a call in private. He stepped into the hallway and then into the kitchen where he called his daughter's number. As usual, she didn't answer. Her primary use of the cell phone was for texting and checking her social media. But Bosch also knew that while she might not answer his calls or even know about them, her phone's ringer was perpetually silenced. She did listen to the messages he left. As expected, the call rang through to message.
Hey, it's your dad. Just wanted to check on you. Hope everything is good and you're safe. I might be traveling through the OC sometime this week on my way to San Diego on a case. Let me know if you want to grab a coffee or something to eat. Maybe dinner.
Okay, that's it. Love you and hope to see you soon. Oh, and put water in that dog bowl. After disconnecting, he stepped out the front door of the house, where there was a patrol officer on post. His name was Hernandez.
Who's boss tonight? Bosch asked.
Sergeant Rosenberg, Hernandez said.
Can you hit him up and see if he'll swing by and grab me? I need to get back to the station.
Yes, sir. Bosch walked out to the curb to wait for the patrol car with Erwin Rosenberg to come along. He needed a ride, but he also needed to tell Rosenberg, who was watch commander for the night, to have patrol keep an eye on Beatrice Sahagun's house. He checked his phone and saw that he had just gotten a text back from Maddie saying she was up for dinner if he was passing through, and that there was a restaurant she had been wanting to try. Bosch replied that they would set it up as soon as his schedule became clear. He knew that his daughter, the San Diego trip, and the Vance case were all going to be put on hold for at least a couple days. He would have to stay with the screen cutter case, if only to be ready to respond to what the media spotlight would invariably bring in.
Chapter 20.
Bosch was the first one into the detective bureau Saturday morning, and the only thing that would have made him prouder was if he had stayed all night working the case. But his status as volunteer allowed him to choose his hours, and he chose a solid night's sleep over chasing a case till dawn. He was too old for that. That he would reserve for homicides. On his way through the police station, he had stopped by the communications room and picked up the stack of messages that had come in since the news about the serial rapist hit the media the evening before. He also dropped by the evidence control unit and checked out the knife recovered at the crime scene. Now at his desk, he sipped the iced latte he had picked up at Starbucks and started wading through the messages. As he did an initial run-through, he created a second pile for messages, in which it was noted that the caller spoke Spanish only. These he would give to Lourdes to review and follow up on. She was expected to work the screen cutter case through the weekend. Sisto was on call for all other cases needing a detective, and Captain Trevino was due in because it was his rotation weekend to be in charge of the department. Among the Spanish-only messages was an anonymous call from a woman who reported that she had also been attacked by a rapist who wore a mask like those worn by Mexican wrestlers. She refused to reveal her name because she admitted she was illegally in the country, and the police operator could not convince her that no action would be taken against her on her immigration status if she fully reported the crime. Bosch had always expected that there were other cases he didn't know about, but it was still a heartbreaking message to read because the woman told the operator that the attack had occurred almost 3 years earlier. Bosch realized that the victim had lived with the psychological and perhaps even physical consequences of the horrible assault for all that time without even being able to hold on to the hope that justice would someday prevail and her attacker would be held to answer for his crime. She had given all of that up when she chose not to report the crime, for fear it would lead to her deportation. There were people that would have no sympathy for her, Bosch knew. People who would argue that her remaining silent about the attack allowed the rapist to move on to the next victim without concern about police attention. Bosch could find some validity in that, but he was more sympathetic to the plight of the silent victim. Without even knowing the details of how she had gotten to this country, Bosch knew her path here had not been easy, and her desire to stay, no matter what the consequences, even to be silent about a rape, was what touched him. Politicians could talk about building walls and changing laws to keep people out, but in the end they were just symbols. Neither would stop the tide any more than the rock jetties at the mouth of the port did. Nothing could stop the tide of hope and desire. Bosch walked around the cubicle and put the stack of Spanish-only messages down on Lourdes's desk. It was the first time he had ever come around and seen her workspace from this angle. There was a usual array of police bulletins and wanted flyers. There was a flyer depicting a missing woman that had haunted the department for 10 years because she had never been found, and foul play was feared. Pinned at center to the half wall separating their desks were several photos of a child, a boy. Some of the photos showed him being held by Lourdes or another woman, and some depicted all three in group hugs. He paused for a moment to lean down and look at the happiness in the photos, and just then the door to the bureau opened and Lourdes entered. "What are you doing?" she asked as she picked up a marker and wrote a start time on the squad attendance board.
I was just putting these phone messages down for you," he said as he backed up to give her room to enter her space. "The Spanish language calls from last night."
Lourdes swung around him and into her cubicle.
"Okay. Thank you. Hey, is that your kid?"
"Yes, Rodrigo."
"I didn't know you had a kid."
"It happens." There was an awkward silence while she waited for Bosch to ask if the other woman was part of the relationship and which one actually bore the child, or if he was adopted. Bosch chose not to pursue it.
"That top message there is from another victim," he said, as he started moving back around the cubicles to his own desk. "She wouldn't give a name but said she was an illegal. The comm center said she called on a payphone by the courthouse."
"Well, we knew there were probably more out there," Lourdes said.
"I've got a stack over here to go through as well, and I pulled the knife from evidence control."
"The knife? Why?"
"These high-end military knives are collector's items. It might be traceable." He returned to his desk and dropped out of Lourdes' sight. Bosch looked first at the stack of messages that he knew would probably exhaust a good part of his day with little or no return, and then at the knife. He chose the knife. He first put on a pair of latex gloves and then removed the weapon from the plastic evidence bag.
The noise made during the removal from the bag drew Lourdes up on her feet and looking over the partition.
I never saw it last night, she said.
Bosch held it up so she could see it close.
That looks completely fucking savage, she said.
Definitely for use on a silent kill squad, he said. He drew the knife back and held it horizontally with the edge of the blade out. He pantomimed attacking someone from behind, covering the mouth with his right hand, and then sticking the point of the blade into a target's neck with his left. He then sliced outward with the knife.
You go in the side and slice out through all the bleeders in the throat, he said.
No sound. The target bleeds out in under 20 seconds. Done.
The target, Lourdes said.
Were you one of those guys, Harry?
In a war, I mean?
I was in a war long before you were born. But we didn't have anything like this. We used to put boot polish on our blades. She looked confused. So they wouldn't catch a reflection in the dark, he said.
Of course, she said.
He put the knife down on his desk, embarrassed by his demonstration.
You think our guy is ex-military? Lourdes asked.
No, I don't, Bosch said.
Why?
Because he ran yesterday. I think if he had any training, he would have regrouped, recovered, and advanced. He would have gone right back at Beatrice, maybe killed her. Lourdes stared at him for a moment, and then nodded toward the iced latte, putting a watermark on the blotter.
Was she there today when you went in?
No, not there. Not surprising. But she might just be off on Saturdays.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start calling some of these people back. Hope it doesn't bother you.
No, no bother. She disappeared from sight again, and Bosch put on his reading glasses to examine the knife. But as he looked down at the weapon on his blotter, he saw something else. He saw the face of a man he had killed in a tunnel more than 40 years before. Bosch had pushed himself back into a crevasse in the tunnel, and the man had come right past him in the darkness. Hadn't seen him. Hadn't smelled him. Bosch grabbed him from behind, put one hand over his face and mouth, and tore through the man's throat with his knife. It was over so quickly and efficiently that not a drop of the arterial spray got on Bosch. He always remembered the man's last breath exhaling against the palm of the hand he had clamped over his mouth. He remembered closing the man's eyes with his hand as he laid him down in his blood.
Harry!
Bosch came out of the memory. Captain Trevino was standing behind him in the cubicle.
Sorry, I was just thinking, Bosch sputtered. What's up, Cap?
Sign the board, Trevino said. I don't want to have to keep telling you. Bosch swiveled in his chair to see Trevino pointing toward the door where the board was located.
Right, right. I'll do it now.
He stood up and Trevino stepped back, so he could leave the cubicle. The captain spoke to his back.
That's the knife? Trevino asked.
That's the knife, Bosch said. Bosch grabbed a marker off the board's sill and put down that he had arrived at 6:15 that morning. He hadn't exactly checked the time, but he knew he had been at the Starbucks at 6 o'clock. Trevino went into his office and shut the door. Bosch returned to the knife on his desk. This time he put the time travel aside and leaned down so he could read the numbers stamped on the black blade. On one side of the titanium edge logo was the date of manufacture, 09/08, and on the other side was a number Bosch assumed was the weapon's unique serial number. He wrote both of these down, and then went online to see if Titanium Edge had a website. As he did so, he heard Lourdes start on one of the callbacks in Spanish. Bosch understood enough to know she was calling someone who had fingered a person she knew as the rapist. Bosch knew it would be a quick call. The investigators were 95% sure they were looking for a white man. Any caller accusing a Latino would be wrong, and most likely engaged in trying to make a personal enemy's life difficult. Bosch found the Titanium Edge site and quickly learned that owners of their knives could register them at purchase or thereafter. It was not required, and Bosch guessed that in most cases, purchasers had not bothered. The knife manufacturer was located in Pennsylvania, close to the steel mills that produced the raw materials of their weapons. The website showed that the company made several different folding knives. Not knowing if the business would be open on a Saturday, Bosch took a shot and called the number listed on the website. His call was answered by an operator, and he asked for the supervisor on duty.
We have Johnny and George here today. They're the guys in charge.
Is one of them available? He asked.
Doesn't matter which.
She put Bosch on hold, and 2 minutes later, a gruff male voice came on the line. If there was a voice to match a Black Blade knife maker, it was this one.
This is Johnny.
Johnny, this is Detective Bosch with the SFPD out in California. I was wondering if I could have a few minutes of your time to help with an investigation we have going out here. There was a pause. Bosch had taken to using the abbreviation SFPD when making calls outside the city, because the chances were good that the receiver of the call would jump to the conclusion that Bosch was calling from the San Francisco Police Department and would be more willing to help than if they knew he was calling from tiny San Fernando.
SFPD, Johnny finally said. I've never even been to California.
Well, it's not about you, sir, Bosch said. It's about a knife that we recovered from a crime scene.
Was someone hurt with it?
Not that we're aware of. A burglar dropped it when he was chased from a house where he had broken in.
Sounds like he was going to use it to hurt somebody.
We'll never know. He dropped it, and I'm trying to trace it. I see from your website that purchasers can register them. I was wondering if I could find out if this one is registered.
Which one is it?
It's a SOCOM Black, 4-inch black powdered blade. On the blade it says it was made in September 08.
Yeah, we don't make that one anymore.
But it is still highly regarded, and a collector's item from what I've been told.
Well, let me look it up here on the computer and see what we got.
Bosch was buoyed by the cooperation. Johnny asked for the serial number, and Bosch read it to him off the blade. Harry could hear him tap into a computer.
Well, it's registered, Johnny said, but unfortunately that's a stolen knife.
Really? Bosch said. But this was not surprising to him. He thought it unlikely that a serial rapist would use a weapon that could be traced directly to him, even if he narcissistically assumed that he would never lose the knife or be identified as a suspect.
Yeah, stolen a couple years after the original purchaser bought it, Johnny said. At least that's when he notified us.
Well, it's been recovered, Bosch said, and that owner will be getting it back after we're finished with the case. Can you give me that information? Here was where Bosch hoped that Johnny wouldn't ask for a warrant. That would slow pursuit of this lead down to a crawl. Rousing a judge on a weekend to sign a warrant for a small part of an investigation was not something he relished doing.
We are always happy to help out the military and law enforcement, Johnny said patriotically.
Bosch then wrote down the name and address as of 2010 of the original buyer of the knife. He was Jonathan Danbury, and his address, at least back then, was in Santa Clarita, no more than a 30-minute drive up the 5 freeway from San Fernando. Bosch thanked Johnny the knife maker for his cooperation and ended the phone call. He immediately went to the DMV database to see if he could locate Jonathan Danbury. He quickly learned that Danbury still lived in the same house as when he reported the knife stolen in 2010. Bosch also learned that Danbury was now 36 years old and had no criminal record. Bosch waited while he heard Lourdes finish a call in Spanish. The moment she hung up, he got her attention.
Bella.
What? Ready to take a ride? I've got a line on the knife. A guy up in Santa Clarita who reported it stolen 6 years ago. She popped her head up over the privacy wall.
I'm ready to shoot myself is what I am, she said. These people, they're just ratting out their old boyfriends, anybody they want to have the cops hassle. And a lot of date rapes, sad to say. Women who think the guy who forced himself on them is our guy.
We're going to keep getting those calls until we find the real guy, Bosch said.
I know, I was just hoping to spend tomorrow with my son, but I'll be stuck here if these calls keep coming.
I'll take tomorrow. You take off. I'll leave all the Spanish-only calls for Monday.
Really?
Really.
Thank you. Do we know how the knife was stolen back then?
Not yet. Ready to go?
Could this be our guy?
Report the knife stolen as a cover? Bosch shrugged and pointed at his computer. His record's clean, he said. The profiler said look for priors, little stuff that builds up to the big stuff.
Profilers don't always get it right, she said.
I'll drive. That last sentence was a joke between them. As a reserve officer, Bosch was given no city vehicle. Lourdes had to drive if they were conducting official police business. On the way out of the bureau, Lourdes stopped to note the time and their destination, SCV, on the board by the squad room door. Bosch didn't. Chapter 21. The Santa Clarita Valley was a sprawling bedroom community, built into the cleft of the San Gabriel and Santa Susana Mountains. It was north of the city of Los Angeles, and buffered from it and its ills by those same mountain chains. It was a place that from its beginning drew families north from the city, families looking for cheaper homes, newer schools, greener parks, and less crime. Those same features were also the draw for hundreds of law officers who wanted to get away from the places they protected and served. It was said that over time, Santa Clarita became the safest place in the country to live because there was a cop residing on almost every block. But even with that deterrent and the mountains as a wall, the ills of the city were inescapable, and they eventually started to migrate through the mountain passes and into the neighborhoods and parks. Jonathan Danbury could attest to that. He told Bosch and Lourdes that his $300 titanium edge knife had been stolen from the glove compartment of his car parked right in the driveway of his house on Featherstar Avenue. To add insult to injury, the theft occurred right across the street from the home of a sheriff's deputy. It was a nice neighborhood of middle to upper middle class homes, with a natural drainage swale called the Haskell Canyon Wash running behind it. Danbury had answered the door in a t-shirt, board shorts, and flip-flops. He explained that he was an internet-based travel agent who worked from home, while his wife sold real estate in the Saugus area of the valley. He said he had forgotten all about his stolen knife until Bosch presented it in its evidence bag. "Never thought I'd see that again," he said. "Wow." "You reported it stolen to Titanium Edge 6 years ago," Bosch said. "Was there a report made with the sheriff's department, too?" Santa Clarita had no police department and had contracted since its inception with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. "I called them," Danbury said. "In fact, Tillman, the deputy who lived across the street back then, came over and took the report, but nothing ever came of it." "You get a follow-up from a detective?" Bosch asked. "I think I remember getting a call, but they weren't too enthused about it. The detective thought it was probably just kids in the neighborhood. I thought that was pretty bold." He pointed across the street to illustrate the story. "There was a sheriff's car parked right there, and my car is right here, 20 feet away, and these kids have the cojones to break into the car to steal my knife?" "They break the window, set off the car's alarm?" "Nope. The detective concluded I left the car unlocked, made it sound like I was at fault. But I didn't leave it unlocked. I never do. I think those kids had a Slim Jim or something, and they got in without breaking the window." "So no arrests came about, as far as you know?" "If there were, they sure as shit didn't tell me." "Did you keep a copy of the report, sir?" Lourdes asked. "I did, but that was a long time ago," Danbury said. "I got 3 kids and run a business out of here. That's why I'm not asking you in. The place is a perpetual mess, and I would need some time to look for the report and all the debris that we call a house." He laughed. Bosch didn't. Lourdes just nodded. Danbury pointed at the evidence bag. "So I don't see any blood on it," Danbury said. "Please don't tell me someone was stabbed or something." "Nobody was stabbed," Bosch said. "Seems like it would be something serious for you to come all the way up here." "It was serious, but we're not at liberty to discuss it." Bosch reached into the inside pocket of his jacket and acted like he didn't find what he was looking for. He then patted his other pockets. "You don't have a smoke I could borrow, do you, Mr. Danbury?" he asked. "No, don't smoke," Danbury said. "Sorry." He pointed to the knife. "Well, will I get it back?" he asked. "It's probably worth more than what I paid for it. People collect those." "So I've heard," Bosch said. "Detective Lourdes will give you her card. You can check with her in a few weeks about getting it back." "Can I ask you something?" "Why'd you have the knife?" "Well, to be honest, I've got a brother-in-law who's ex-military, and he collects this sort of stuff. I thought maybe it would be good to have some protection, but I think I mostly got it to impress him. I ordered it, and at first I kept it in my night table. But then I realized that was stupid. It might end up hurting one of the kids. So I put it in the glove box. I actually forgot about it until I got in the car one day and saw the box was open. I checked and the knife was gone." "Anything else taken?" Lourdes asked. "No, just the knife," Danbury said. "That was the only thing of value in the whole car."
Bosch nodded, then turned and glanced back to the house across the street.
"Where did the deputy move?" he asked.
"I don't know," Danbury said. "We weren't really friends. I think it might have been Simi Valley."
Bosch nodded. They had gleaned what they could about the knife from Danbury, and he had seemingly passed the smoke test. He decided to ask a door slammer, a question that could result in the angry end of a voluntary conversation.
"Do you mind telling us where you were yesterday around lunchtime?" he asked.
Danbury looked at them uncomfortably for a moment, and then broke into an awkward smile.
"Hey, come on, what is this?" he asked.
"Am I a suspect in something?"
"It's a routine question," Bosch said. "The knife was recovered in a burglary yesterday about noon. It would just save us some time if you could tell us where you were. That way our boss doesn't see it's not in the report and send us back here to bother you."
Danbury reached back and put his hand on the doorknob. He was close to ending things and slamming the door on them.
"I was here all day long," he said curtly, "except when I took two of my kids home sick from school to the doctor around 11. All that can be easily checked. Anything else?"
"No, sir," Bosch said. "Thanks for your time."
Lourdes handed Danbury a business card and followed Bosch off the front stoop. They heard the door close sharply behind them. They drove back toward the freeway and stopped at the drive-thru at a fast-food franchise so Bosch could eat something while they headed south. Lourdes said she had eaten earlier and passed. They did not speak about the interview at first. Bosch wanted to think about the conversation with Danbury before discussing it. Once they were on the 5 and Lourdes had opened the windows to blow out the smell of fast food, he brought it up.
"So what do you think about Danbury?" he asked.
Lourdes closed the windows.
"I don't know," she said. "I was hoping he'd know who took the knife. We need to pull the sheriff's report just to see if they did look at anybody."
"So you're not thinking he reported it stolen as a cover?"
"Reported it stolen and then 2 years later started raping people in San Fernando?
I don't think it hunts," Lourdes said. "The reported rape started 2 years later. As we know from last night's callers, there are probably other rapes. They could have started earlier."
"True, but I don't see Danbury. His record's clean, he doesn't fit the profile, doesn't smoke, is married, has kids."
"You said profilers aren't always right," Bosch reminded her. "He has his lunchtimes free working from home and with the kids in school.
But not yesterday. He gave us an alibi we could easily check with the doctor in the school. It's not him, Harry."
Bosch nodded. He agreed, but felt it was good to play devil's advocate to avoid tunnel thinking.
"It's still weird when you think about it," Lourdes said.
"Think about what?" Bosch asked.
"How a knife stolen up here in blue-eyed Santa Clarita ends up with a white guy wearing masks and going after Latinas in San Fernando?"
"Yeah, we've talked about the racial side of this. Maybe we have to hit harder now."
"Yeah, how?"
"Go back to the LAPD. They probably keep files at Foothill and Mission on racist threats, arrests, that sort of thing. Maybe we come up with some names."
"Okay, I can do that."
"Monday. Take tomorrow off. Planning on it."
But he knew she had volunteered to make the contact with the LAPD divisions because of the animosity toward Bosch in some quarters of the department. She wanted to make sure she got access to LAPD files and didn't get stiffed because somebody had a grudge against Bosch.
"Where do you live, Bella?" he asked.
"Chatsworth," she said. "We have a house off Winnepka."
"Nice."
"We like it, but it's the same everywhere. It's all about the schools. We've got good schools."
Bosch guessed from the photos he saw pinned to the separation wall that Rodrigo was no more than 3 years old. Lourdes was already worried about his future.
"I've got a 19-year-old, he said. "A girl. She had some hard knocks in her life. Lost her mother young. But she made it through. Kids are amazing, as long as they have the push in the right direction at home."
Lourdes just nodded, and Bosch felt like a fool for dispensing unwanted and obvious advice.
"Rodrigo a Dodgers fan?" he asked.
"He's a little young, but he will be," she said.
"Then it's you. You said Beatrice swung the broomstick like Adrian Gonzalez."
"Gonzalez was a fan favorite, especially among the Latino fan base."
"Yeah, we love going to Chavez Ravine and watching Gonzo."
Bosch nodded and changed the subject back to work.
"So nothing of value in the calls this morning?"
"Nothing. You were right. I don't think anyone is going to pan out, and now this guy knows we've connected the dots. Why stick around?"
I haven't even gotten to my stack. Maybe we'll get lucky. Once back at the station, Bosch finally dug into his stack of tips.